Earlier this year, Leo Varadkar, Taoiseach of the Republic of Ireland, announced that he was standing down. Varadkar's resignation prompted widespread bewilderment. He'd only just turned 45 and was in good health. His approval ratings were decent-ish. He wasn't due to face Ireland's voters for another year or so. There was no immediately apparent looming scandal, no skeleton scraping at the closet door. He had just had a couple of referendum proposals rejected by his fellow citizens, but worse things can happen. Even other members of Varadkar's own party, Fine Gael, didn't see his going coming. Varadkar, if we take him at his word, had simply had enough. In walking away, he joined that exclusive and rather enviable coterie of politicians who leave office at a time and in a manner of their own choosing, rather than being ejected by the electorate, knifed by their colleagues, or compelled to depart in disgrace. Given the extraordinary effort it generally requires to reach the top in politics, and given that leading a country is, one assumes, a pretty interesting job which sometimes comes with a nice house and a cool car with flags on the bonnet, it does seem a somewhat bizarre decision to make. But people do make it. How does a leader know when their time is up? How tough a call is it? And do they ever have any regrets? This is The Foreign Desk.
When I became party leader and Taoiseach back in June 2017, I knew that one part of leadership is knowing when the time has come to pass on the baton to somebody else, and then having the courage to do it. That time is now.
And so today I'm announcing that I will not be seeking re-election. I am leaving, because with such a privileged role comes responsibility. The responsibility to know when you are the right person to lead, and also when you are not. I know what this job takes, and I know that I no longer have enough in the tank to do it justice.
I announced that I'm resigning, and that was it. Because I don't believe that the presidency is balancing the power of the executive. If I would have stayed these 2 years, what would have changed? Nothing. I will be just basically ill. Be sitting there and calling myself president that couldn't contribute anything.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. Joining us, first of all, is Pat Leahy, political editor of The Irish Times. Pat, let's go back to that announcement of Leo Varadkar's decision to step down as Taoiseach. Had there been any indication at all that this was coming?
Really, there hadn't, Andrew. And I suppose some of us who, you know, watch politics on a daily basis and try and report on and interpret it, have been kind of beating ourselves up slightly since then, and kind of looking back at various things in the past and thinking to ourselves, well, we should really have seen, you know, that maybe there was something coming. I guess that's the benefit of hindsight. What is true, I think, is that there had been a general perception, whilst this wasn't really tied to particular events or speeches or anything like that, but there was a general sense that Leo Varadkar, in his second period as Taoiseach, hadn't really grasped it with the sort of hands-on enthusiasm and application and constant focus that he had done when he first became Taoiseach. So just to remind your listeners, he became Taoiseach, our Prime Minister, in 2017, and he was in the role until 2020. Then his Fine Gael party formed a coalition government after the 2020 election with their old rivals in Fianna Fáil. But the Fianna Fáil leader was Taoiseach for the first half of that government. And at the end of 2022, Leo Varadkar swapped roles with the leader of Fianna Fáil, Micheál Martin, and became Taoiseach again. And there was very much a feeling in Fine Gael that while it had been a quiet period for both him and a difficult period for the party in the opinion polls in 21 and 22, that with Leo Varadkar back in the Taoiseach's office, that the, you know, he would take the reins again, that the party's profile and therefore its opinion poll scores would improve. That really never happened. And I think it's fair to say that, albeit it's with the benefit of hindsight, for 6 months to a year before he resigned, people were asking quietly, what's going on with Leo? you couldn't say that you would tie that to specific events or anything, but there was a general sense that he just wasn't as on his game as Taoiseach as he had been in the first 3 years when he filled the role.
And in the week since he left, has there been any intimation either from Varadkar himself or from people close to him about what the tipping point was, the reason he finally decided, actually, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm out?
So when he was announcing his resignation, he cited both personal and political factors. He didn't go on to spell those out, but I think he was being pretty honest about that. I suppose we learned one more thing throughout that interview on The Late Late Show on RTE, where he said that he nearly chickened out of the plan to resign the night before. We didn't learn more about his motivations. I mean, I suppose he elaborated slightly on those in the interview, on the personal toll that it took on him. He said, "You're never not Taoiseach." And that's undoubtedly true. But I think that what the interview brought out, I suppose, a little bit more is the strain that that took, that constantly being Taoiseach, never being off, took on him personally. And as we discussed before, I suppose that is cumulative. It mounts up and ultimately led him to where he was. He made one substantive intervention, maybe his final intervention in public debate, where he talked about how he was concerned that racism was increasing in Ireland. As in the UK, there's a debate about immigration that is going to the centre of our politics now. And Mr. Varadkar talked about how he was concerned about that. And I suppose as somebody who has, you know, grown up in a mixed-race household himself, he has a particular insight on it. I think the political factors are the ones we can see, and they are, you know, his party was under pressure in the polls. He's facing into local and European elections in a couple of weeks and a general election at some stage before March of next year. And his party was on course for a bit of a hiding. So, you know, you can see the political difficulties that faced him. That having been said, prime ministers don't normally choose to go. It's normally the decision of either the voters in general or their parties that forces them out. And I think there were personal factors at play as well. And again, Varadkar said this when he was giving the reasons for his resignation. And, you know, we're in the realms of speculation to a degree here, but I've been watching him closely for many years. And I think the best explanation is that Leo Varadkar's life changed massively in the last 6 or 7 years or so. He came out as a gay man in 2015. Since then, he developed a relationship with someone with whom he now lives. They have a life together. You know, he has, by all accounts, a pretty active social life. And I think those are things that he just didn't have before. His whole life had been politics. And I think he came to the realization that actually there is more to life than politics. Now, most politicians of his age, they grow up with having, you know, a family life or whatever in parallel with their political life, and they can manage the interaction between the two. Varadkar never had that. He only really developed that side of his life, I think, in the full glare of publicity when he was very much at the top of the political tree. And I think he found that harder and harder. And ultimately, he found it impossible to sustain. And I think he was being honest. And I think he was being accurate when he talked about political and personal factors coming together, which brought him to this decision.
The first politician in history who's actually standing down to spend more time with his family. Pat Leahy, thank you for joining us. This is the Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio, and we'll hear next from Raj Nana, Chief of Staff to former New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who stepped down in January 2023. Raj joined us from Wellington. I began by asking whether Ardern's decision to go had been a long and considered process or a more sudden revelation.
It was a pretty considered process. I mean, she's by nature a considered person, and, you know, it's a big call, so you want to make sure that you get it right. She really took the time to be clear in her own mind and teasing out whether or not, you know, she was just at a low point or whether it was the final point. You know, and I was looking back at it and thinking that, you know, the sheer accumulation of events, the unprecedented nature of those, the relentlessness with which they presented themselves, you know, Christchurch terror attacks, Whakaari, White Island and COVID. And, you know, when you give everything you've got to those moments, it takes a particular toll. But I think it was only when weighing that against the prospect of asking the country for another full term that it cast in a particularly stark relief.
The phrase she famously used was nothing left in the tank. And from what you've described, obviously, it's a tiring job at the best of times. But yeah, she did have to grapple with an extraordinary sequence of crises for anybody, never mind the Prime Minister of New Zealand, which is usually a fairly placid beat in many respects. But was it...
I think the professors might disagree with it.
But was there any amount of political expedience attached to it? Was she worried that she might not get asked to go round again at the next election?
No, not really. That's how she phrased it in our conversations, and that ended up being, you know, what she told the public. The election actually featured more as a consideration for the successor. You know, you want to give the successor the cleanest transition possible. There's a lot of decisions that you make in an election year, and particularly at the start of the year, and some of those big positioning speeches when Parliament opens, when we have Waitangi Day. And you wanted to give your successor that platform and that ability to make those decisions, election year budget, election year platform, the list process. So it was more about giving them as much time as possible to get their feet under the desk and make the calls that matter in an election year.
Did you get a sense that she felt herself under any pressure to continue for the sake of the people around her? Because obviously for any senior politician, there are a lot of people around them whose jobs depend on that person occupying that position. Do you get a sense, whether you've seen it with Jacinda Ardern or with other politicians, that they kind of feel an obligation to their colleagues to continue?
Yeah, I definitely think it's a factor. It's not just their colleagues. You know, you think about the party and the country as well, and you've made a commitment. I suppose that calculation comes down to being prime minister requires nothing less than your total commitment. There's too much at stake, and as to your point, there's too many people that rely on you for it to be anything less. And you can't fake commitment. You can't fake drive. So once you've kind of reached that point and you realise you've reached that point, it is time to go. And you owe it to the people that rely on you to be honest about that and upfront about it.
So what kind of conversations went on once the decision had been made about what we tell the country and when we tell the country?
I mean, once you make the decision, the question of when has really answered itself. You kind of can't stick around there for the reasons that I just mentioned. You know, I mean, there are some really just plainly practical considerations, like a decision like that, she needs to talk to some colleagues. You want to have some face-to-face conversations. So you're trying to pick a moment when they're all together. But I think that the primary driver was to be as quick as possible, to be as clean as possible.
As someone who has seen the pressures that a national leader is under up close, has it ever been frustrating to you that it's very difficult to think of a politically acceptable way you can explain that to the electorate? Because obviously the last thing the electorate wants to hear is a politician whinging about how tough their job is. But it is a tough job. And the people who do it, especially at the level of national leader, are under extraordinary psychological, physical pressures. They must be perpetually exhausted, perpetually stressed. But there's a real unwillingness to forgive that or adjust for that. Is that frustrating when you're the person immediately behind that national leader?
I mean, that's the reality, right? You just have to accept that and get on with the job. I mean, it is relentless. It's less of a job and more of a lifestyle. I think the public do get a sense of that. Particularly in moments of crisis, people understand and they can see the toll it takes on the leaders, but they rightly have high expectations of their leaders. You know, in New Zealand, we have been really fortunate to have a series of very capable leaders at the top for quite a while now, and they've set the bar high. And so the public now expect you to hit that standard, and it is difficult. But I'm not quite sure what the alternative is. You should have to hit that standard in order to be successful. And we give leaders extraordinary power and massive influence. And so 80 to 90 hour weeks every day, week in, week out, is part of the burden they have to bear for the extraordinary privilege that they get.
And do you think part of being a successful leader is, well, to come back to the theme of this show, knowing when to quit? Because even if you do feel exhausted, and I'm sure most of them do, at many levels, and you see it a lot in politics, there are people who don't know when to go because there are a lot of things about it you would miss, right? You would miss the power, you would miss the prestige, you would miss the pleasant residence and the car and the driver and all the cool stuff that goes along with being a senior office holder. Some people do find it really hard to walk away from.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, clearly we've seen that. Part of success should be knowing when it's time to go. There are a whole lots of moments when you're a leader, when you're asked to put the interests of the country ahead of your own. And, you know, to the point that you just raised, some of the toll that the general job takes is exactly that, right? You're sacrificing time with your family and your loved ones, your friends, in order to do the job. And this is another one of those decisions that, you know, if you don't have it within yourself, you owe it to the country to go. But one of the things about that calculation is it's so deeply personal. The only person that can really know is the person who sits in the chair. And I think we've seen some overseas examples where the person in the chair feels like, you know, they've got it within themselves to keep going. Now to the electorate to make the decision.
Just finally then, because it is something I have always been curious about for somebody in your role, is it ever part of your job to try and manage that workload and manage those stresses? Do you ever find yourself having to find a way to say to the Prime Minister, seriously, go home, put on a film, put your feet up, take a weekend off?
Yeah, for sure. That is part of it, particularly for someone like her, who's just, you want to get it right. And so keeps working as hard as she possibly can. I mean, part of the reality is there's no off switch for a prime minister. Mm. Once you get the warrant, that's it. It sits on your shoulders and it's a fairly weighty responsibility. But the office and family and that are part of the job there is to try and manage the ebb and flow of it and create a bit more balance, get time where they can watch your movies, spend time with family and friends. And you're also trying to make sure that it's part of the day-to-day job that they get exposure to the great things that really fill their bucket, you know, that they get to see the people that they are in the role to serve and that they get to see some of the benefits of the policies that are put in place in the community and say, you know what, that's why I'm doing this job. That's why I make these sacrifices. It's worth it. And so you're trying to reach that balance, right? You never kind of get it right, but that's the gig.
That was Raj Nana, Chief of Staff to former New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. This is The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Our next guest is one of those leaders who chose to walk away. Armen Sarkissian was president of Armenia from 2018 to 2022. He had previously served as prime minister between 1996 and 1997. I began by asking President Sarkissian to think back to January 2022 and whether it was possible to explain concisely why he decided to step aside as president.
I'll try. But to be honest, that's not the only big decision that I had to make, dramatic decision in my life. First, you remember I was prime minister as well, and I resigned because I made the decision to resign. When I became prime minister in 96, what happened in 97, they discovered that I had tumor. It was another event that I discovered there is a God, because you can have all of these plans, and I knew exactly what I had to do, how to do the reforms. And I was very confident. It was the second person that had a role in my life that was first president of Armenia, Ter Petrosyan, said, no, no, you have to take it seriously. Go back and do your surgery. And in the meantime, I will serve as acting prime minister, which was strange. So that was a very, very tough decision for me because I was forced to do that by life. I didn't want to do it at all. But I realized if I don't concentrate on fighting cancer, I would die. Mm. And I didn't want my children to have the same feelings when I lost my father when I was 10.
Do you think those decisions made it easier for you to make the decision to step aside from the presidency when you had to make that decision?
Well, I'm coming to that. It's only two episodes probably that I would share with you. There was a ghost with me all the time, like in Shakespeare's Hamlet. It was unfinished business in my mind. And that was coming with me all the time. And I then made the decision that I want to go back. And then eventually in 2017, I was offered to think about the possibility of running a president. And in the new republic, because we, in 2015, we changed the constitution. And I had to think about it. And I had long discussions. The offer came from the third president of Armenia, which was on his way out. But he had his own plans to stay as a prime minister. Well, I had a problem with that because the constitution was designed most probably for the prime minister. And the president didn't have any power at all. I couldn't veto any law, nothing. But I was assured publicly by then the president, and he said that publicly twice, that I will basically be responsible for foreign policy, foreign economic policy, investments, diaspora. And I added that I want also science, academia, and culture, which was agreed. That means that they had to change the constitution. And I was very, very tough on that issue because I do believe that you can exercise democracy. Democracy doesn't start and end with elections. One element of that is checks and balances. If you don't have checks and balances, which didn't exist in any former Soviet republics after the independence, then you will lose your democracy. Eventually, through a democratic process, you will end up with a non-democratic state. Because there has to be balance of power.
Were you frustrated by the lack of power that came with the president's role?
Not a lack of power, the lack of possibility for someone like me to contribute positively into the life of Armenia. Someone like me with that sort of a life experience cannot sit there and be happy that he's the president. Somebody opens the door for him and you have a car. I don't know what. You travel as president and you sign, you think that you are important. Well, you are not because you don't contribute. And I had big sort of an internal problem with that. Then what happened, as you know, after my inauguration, in 2 weeks' time, there was this Velvet Revolution. And I thought I should stay because I have a role to keep the country stable. Because the first day what was happening, I had to go into the crowd, into the square, to keep everything calm and not to allow a clash between police and special forces with the demonstrators. So I found, okay, these are young people came to power. Maybe they can listen to me, my life, and I can contribute. And of course, then there is history. I spoke even at that time about changing the constitution, but a lot of journalists were interpreting that I want to change it for my own power. But I made it clear, let's change the constitution. The moment we change the constitution, I retire. It's not about me.
Was there a particular moment you can remember deciding, that's it, I can't go on anymore?
I'll tell you now. It never happens like that. You just sit down and decide to resign. It's your lifetime. So then there was the war, and my contribution to peace or anything was absolute minimum because I didn't have any power. Even I was not a member of the Security Council of the country. That frustrates you. I tried to make a contribution when the war finished. I advised that the prime minister should resign. Because when you are the leader that lost the war, you cannot continue negotiating. You are negotiating from the weak point. And my advice to him was very simple. You resign. You control the parliament. Go and run the country from the parliament as the speaker and the head of majority from the parliament. Put someone, a technocrat, as a prime minister. Of course, my advice was not taken as it is because people simplified that. And then we had, as you know, in Armenia, instability, rebellions of the military and the generals. And each time I had to interfere to keep the calm, not take the country into civil war. And then in 2021, when I was pushing the agenda that we have to change the constitution, I had these discussions with the prime minister. And we agreed that we will change the constitution. And 1st of May, publicly announced that I was with president. We agreed that we'll change the constitution in November, the same year, to semi-presidential. And I made it clear, we change the constitution, I retire. You get for you a new president. I will feel that I have achieved something by bringing to balance the power. But people forget we are a remnant of Soviet Union, and our culture is Soviet culture. Is the idea you cannot compare. If you'd have the same constitution for Armenia and Britain, they will work differently. Exactly the same constitution. Because people are different. In Soviet Union, the Tsar was replaced by a Communist Party leader. So everybody was focused. It was authoritarian. It was in the minds of people. Politics was corrupt. And it continued living there like that. So we had to put an extra effort to balance the power, to educate people. So agreement was there. It came the end of 2021, nothing happened. So I felt that there is nothing more that I can do. So that is why in January, I waited New Year fast. I announced that I'm resigning, and that was it. And in my resignation letter, I made it clear why I am resigning. Because I don't believe that the presidency is balancing the power of the executive. And I said that Armenia is going to face very, very tough times, which in reality happened. Armenians lost Karabakh. We have huge refugees. Karabakh was gone, and it's not easy for any power. So if I would have stayed these 2 years, what would have changed? Nothing. I will be just basically ill. Be sitting there and calling myself president that couldn't contribute anything.
For all those frustrations you mentioned, though, that led to you resigning the presidency, is there anything about, just as a final question, anything about the presidency that you miss?
That presidency, no. What I'm missing in, and I miss it until today, that in Armenia, be that a presidential or parliamentary republic, we have to have balance of power. I think it's a very tough process for a small state to build up your future. I am not missing it, to be honest. Not missing it because I had very high hopes, which were crashed, and I was struggling with the situation because I couldn't contribute. The political leadership didn't need me, fine, it's okay. But I was unhappy to stay there without the contribution, positive contribution. The only positive thing is that I just killed the ghost. Because when I retired as prime minister and I was forced to retire, it was not my decision. That was decision of life and my health. If I would not try this and go back, I would be living a life always saying that I had the chance in 2018. I was offered to go and I didn't. If I was there, something would be different than so. So I'm happy that I killed the ghost by trying, which was painful. It had hurt my family. It had hurt me personally, my health. But I'm happy that I tried.
Armin Sarkissian, thank you very much for joining us here on the Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. And finally on today's show, it is time to take a look back through history at some of the most prominent resignations by leaders who chose to leave before they had to be pushed. And I'm joined now by Alex von Tonzelman, the historian, author and screenwriter. Alex, we're going to start with what I think is the absolute daddy of all unforced resignations by somebody who I think probably could have banged on forever if he'd felt like doing it.
Yes, of course, George Washington, really the originator of this. I mean, you know, to put yourself in the mindset of the 18th century, of course, presidents were a rather new thing. And so there were lots of people actually beseeching him to become king. There was certainly at that stage no two-term limits on a presidency. He could just have carried on, but he chose not to. He wrote his very famous farewell address from Mount Vernon. I have a little paragraph of it here for you.
Please.
Though in reviewing the incidents of my administration, I'm unconscious of intentional error, I am nevertheless too sensible of my defects not to think it probable that I may have committed many errors. Whatever they may be, I fervently beseech the Almighty to avert or mitigate the evils to which they may tend. I shall also carry with me the hope that my country will never cease to view them with indulgence, and that after 45 years of my life dedicated to its service with an upright zeal, the faults of incompetent abilities will be consigned to oblivion, as myself must soon be to the mansions of rest.
I'll take things I cannot imagine Donald Trump saying for $500, please, Alex. No, I mean, I do like that one because it reminds me of the time I went to the all the American history stuff in Philadelphia, and I did the guided tour, and it was put very well by the guide, who did say when he stood on the spot where it happened that people assume that July 4th, 1776 is the most important date in American history. And he said it's not. He said it's March 4th, 1797, which was the day that George Washington stood aside as president and applauded as his successor John Adams was sworn in. And he said all those things. This was a pretty new idea. And this laid down that this is how it's going to work here. Power will be transferred peacefully. So George Washington, the inaugurator of, I guess, the person who just walks away from tremendous power because he just feels like his time is up. But we wanted to move into the modern era, largely because there's audio from the modern era. And this was a later occupant of that office.
With America's future under challenge right here at home, with our hopes and the world's hopes for peace and the balance every day, I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Lyndon Baines Johnson there, of course, the 36th President of the United States, hanging it up in 1968. Alex, he'd done a term and a bit, because, of course, he became president upon the assassination of John F. Kennedy in November 1963. He could have, however, gone on for another term, or at least tried to win one, but he chose not to.
That's right. I mean, there were a number of reasons, really. His health wasn't great, which he was very aware of. He actually commissioned a sort of doctor's report on his health, which predicted he would die at 64, which in fact I believe he did. So he sort of didn't want to carry on for that. And then, of course, his popularity had fallen off considerably. And then in these sort of primaries, you had Robert F. Kennedy enter the race. And I think at that point, Johnson really did see the writing on the wall. I mean, there was pretty much no love lost between those two anyway. And of course, at that stage, didn't know how that was going to turn out.
Are we undermining the premise of the episode in bringing this up here? Because you're making this sound like very much a jumped because he realised he was about to be pushed sort of decision.
Well, I think retrospectively, historians have been quite appreciative of some of his achievements in office. And of course, have speculated that had he stayed in office, there might have been a higher chance of an earlier conclusion to the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he wasn't pushed. He could have fought on. Of course, what happened is the minute he said he was going to step down, his approval ratings leapt up much higher than they had been. So actually, he probably could at that point have re-entered and won.
Well, let's move on to a British politician who, it might be argued, people started to miss a bit more than they might have expected once he'd gone.
I've been Prime Minister of this country for just over 10 years. In this job, in the world of today, I think that's long enough for me, but more especially for the country. And sometimes the only way you conquer the pull of power is to set it down.
Tony Blair, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, standing down in 2007 after a decade on the job. It's hard to imagine Blair, given what we know about him and what we might charitably describe as a belief in his own capacities, wanting to be not Prime Minister anymore. And there were machinations occurring, I think, to edge him towards the door. But where does he figure in our pantheon of voluntary stepper downers?
It was pretty voluntary. I mean, he'd said he would serve the full term at that election and then didn't. Now, obviously, there were a number of factors. I think his unpopularity was really going pretty strong after the Iraq War. And there was allegedly this existence of a real flashback to the 90s here, something called the Granita Pact. Now, supposedly, this was a deal in 1994 at the restaurant, then very fashionable, I believe, Granita in Islington, which was between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, who became his chancellor and, of course, took over afterwards, that Brown would start as chancellor, Blair would eventually step down and hand over to Brown, which is, in fact, what happened in 2007, effectively. So supposedly, there was this pact for that to go on. With retrospect, you can always say these people could probably have clung on for longer. But I think there was probably, you know, he was quite young for a prime minister at that stage when he got the prime ministership. I think there was the possibility, distinct possibility of other kind of roles afterwards, perhaps on a then European or global stage. And, you know, it seemed like it was probably time to go before things got too nasty.
Well, let's move along to Europe and another leader who for, well, a protracted period seemed like a pretty permanent fixture.
This ceremony marks the end of an intensive and probably also hard chapter in your lives. Now the door to a new life is opening. That's exciting and inspiring. That's why I want to leave this wish with you. Tear down walls of ignorance and narrow-mindedness, for nothing has to stay as it is.
Now, astute listeners will have guessed that was not Angela Merkel's actual resignation statement, which, of course, she gave in German. That was a commencement speech she gave in English at Harvard University. But again, do you think she was just somebody who thought that this bizarre amount of time I have been in power is long enough?
I think so. And I mean, she was tremendously popular internationally. I mean, within Germany, I think there was considerably more enthusiasm for her to step down and move
on. It is
on.
Very often the case. That...
Isn't it? Yes. Perhaps with a number of people we might speak about today. But yes, I mean, you know, the rest of the world was like, well, we'll have you. But I think she'd had enough. I think straightforwardly, you know, and you do get this sense that, you know, I think these leadership positions like hers can be incredibly stressful, and all leadership positions can be. And, you know, there were these rumours that she really kind of wanted to just go back to a fairly quiet life in academia.
This is something I was wondering about, though, and especially given the research you've done and the books you've written into great events which have been steered by great personalities in positions of great power. Is there, do you think, an optimum amount of time to do the job? I mean, I know the Americans have decided that about 8 years will do you as president, but I struggle to think myself of somebody, if you reflect back on their time in power, really started to hit their stride after 9 or 10 years.
Yes, I mean, I think usually you're pretty clapped out by then. You won't often hear me quoting Enoch Powell, but on this occasion...
Strap yourselves in.
Strap yourselves in. The late racist conservative politician Enoch Powell. But he wrote in his biography of Joseph Chamberlain this line, which gets quoted a lot: all political lives, unless they're cut off in midstream at a happy juncture, end in failure, because that is the nature of politics and of human affairs.
And that is, of course, what these people we've been discussing have been trying to avoid. We will close on one whose reasons for going, I think, were pretty self-evident. But, well, we all might have hoped for various reasons that perhaps even despite his obvious frailties, he'd stuck around a while longer or perhaps chosen a markedly different successor.
I want to ask for your forgiveness, because many of our dreams did not come to pass. Because what had seemed simple turned out to be terribly hard. I ask forgiveness for not fulfilling some of the hopes of the people who believed that we could in one swoop, in one leap, jump from the grey, stagnant, totalitarian past into the radiant, wealthy, and civilized future. I am leaving. I have done everything I can.
Boris Yeltsin, of course, there, Alex, stepping down as president of Russia and making way for somebody who needs no introduction. Just in closing, what do you make of that tone to take? Because that is resignation in more ways than one, by the sound of it. It's like, I had a bash, everybody, screwed pretty much everything up, awfully sorry, I quit, here's Vladimir.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, it really focuses on the, sorry, we didn't really get much done. You know, it seems incredibly downbeat. And of course, that was 31st of December 1999, the end of the millennium. We all thought all the computers were going to pack up the next day. And instead, we had Vladimir Putin. So a different disaster.
The millennium bug turns out to have been the least of our worries. Alex von Tonsermann, thank you very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Chris Chermack, Emma Searle, and Christy O'Grady. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. To contact The Foreign Desk team, you can email Chris at cc@monocle.com, and don't forget to subscribe to Monocle Magazine and our free daily email bulletins by heading to our website at monocle.com. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.